Welcome to the Original Gangsters Podcast. I'm your host, Scott Bernstein. I'm amped for this deep dive into Connecticut organized crime with my main man, Jamie Lawton, the mob buster of all mob busters in the Constitution State. Jamie, thank you for joining me.
Come on, will you? I mean, you can't set me up like that. Team effort, brother. Everything was a team effort, not just me. So.
No, I don't know. I'm not trying to. Obviously, here at the OG, we give mad props to the all the alphabet agencies and the work that they do. I've developed some great relationships with people like yourself over the last two decades. Guys that have, my entire career of reporting and researching can date back to a group of FBI agents in Detroit, or retired FBI, had just left the office. I was getting into this in the mid-2000s. They had just left the office. And for my first year, they literally sat with me, schooled me, put me on to other people that could school me. And then it all, you know, was like a domino effect from there. So you don't have to tell me, man. Everybody on those Connecticut OC squads, you're the standard bearer. That's what we're going to talk about, and you're going to kind of
thank you
prop them up because we know they did a great job.
Sure.
So let's kind of just jump in. Jamie was working OC in the late 90s, 2000s, 2010s. He is aware of some of the stuff that I've been reporting in the last month. I also want to just talk about, you know, I bury the lead here. I talked about how all of my research in Detroit started with these FBI agents. I can trace, you know, I've known Jamie now for about 18 months or so. And, you know, Jamie's the one who really kind of keyed me into all of this and got me hip to a lot of what was going down in Connecticut. So I'm excited to bring him on here and to be able to talk about what he can talk about. So last month, I broke the story that there is a newish leader, crew boss, not necessarily a made guy or a skipper, but of the Patriarch of Crime Family's Connecticut branch, the old wild guy Grasso crew. Beaver Asensia died in 2021. He was pretty youngish. I think he was early 60s. And I'm reporting that a long time, big time earner, I think he's half Italian, Eddie Perrette, is now running things for little Eddie Lato. Good looking Matty Guglielmetti in Providence and the D'Annunzio brothers in Boston. He is their point man in Connecticut. You worked Eddie. Eddie took a drug pinch in the 2000s, did a couple years, owns a place called Doma, which is a pretty accoladed Italian restaurant.
Yep.
People hang out there. Guys from both the Patriarchs and the Gambinos. So I'm going to hand it over to what do you remember about Eddie Perrette?
Well, what happened was I was on a drug task force, a drug gang task force. And with State Police, New Haven PD, it was a joint task force. And we started getting quite a bit of intel about how local Latin Kings were working with Latin Kings, in case people don't know, it's a street gang, Almighty Latin King Nation, that they were working with.
Pretty much the number one Hispanic organized crime group outside of the Mexican.
A lot of Latin Kings here in Connecticut, they have them up in Mass, a lot in Springfield, New York. It's a nationwide gang.
Based on Chicago, but they have a big presence in New England and New York.
So we had LCN associates, and ultimately a soldier who was Anthony Asensia at the time was kind of at the top of the heap, that were working with Latin Kings, selling drugs, and they had a bookmaking operation which was, it was very interesting because it was one of the first, show you how long ago it is, was one of the first offshore bookmaking operations that was known in the United States. And what the way they used to have it set up was all the calls that you made, if you wanted to call up and make a bet, you'd have an account. When you called in, you were actually calling to the country of Costa Rica. So it was offshore. So it was kind of quasi-legal. It wasn't legal here, but it was legal in the country of Costa Rica. And this Latin King LCN connection crew were using that system to do bookmaking. Extension of extortionate credit for the gamblers. And they were also selling a lot of drugs on the side. So we started a case that we called Wise Kings. And we ended up doing a Title III wiretap on these bookmakers. And was one individual that was in the middle of it. And his nickname was Cito. And we were on his phone and we got LCN figures that would pop up in it. We had Latin Kings that popped up and it was a really, really interesting phone. And then the main target died of a massive MI. He was in his mid-20s and he died of a massive MI. And the phone kind of sort of fell apart. So we had to just pick and choose who was indictable and who wasn't.
What's an MI?
And one of the guys who popped up prominently in that case was Eddie Perret.
Jamie, what's an MI? You said he died of an MI. What does that mean?
Oh, a heart attack.
Myocardial
infarction.
Okay. I didn't know what it meant. So I'm guessing my audience wouldn't have understood what that meant. So he died of a heart attack.
Yeah, he died of a heart attack, actually at the hospital. And we couldn't wiretap him anymore because he was dead. So we had to kind of take what was left over and we started working on Eddie Perret, and if he's listening to this, he doesn't realize he was driving around in a car that we put a tracking device on at 3 o'clock in the morning. So we were following him, seeing where he went, and maybe 2 or 3 weeks after we put the tracking device on his car, he sold the car. So of course I'm working for bosses and they're like, you got to get that tracking device back. And the car ended up going all the way out. I think it went out to Michigan, actually. And we had to get it. We had to go to whoever, I can't remember who bought it, and get the tracking device off of it. But Eddie was a really smart, active bookmaker and kind of a straw that stirs the drink type guy for these people that were around him. He knew everybody in New Haven. He was smart. He always paid his bets off. You have a lot of bookmakers that still don't pay their bets off or they try and welch out of it. He always paid his bets and everybody trusted him. But, you know, he had muscle around him. He had guys that would enforce for him and collect debts for him. And he was slick. He was not an easy target to do.
From what I can understand, he started on record with the Gambinos. And for people that might not know Connecticut, you have three main families that operate there, the Gambinos, the Genovese, and the Patriarcas, which is the New England Mafia. That's not to say that other groups don't have action there, not to say the Bananos or Lucchese's or Colombos. I know Colombos have had, I should say that there's four main groups that go there. I think the Colombos have a good amount of action, Gambinos, Genovese, and then Patriarcas, and then Lucchese's and Bananos have stuff there, but they haven't been traditional powerhouses in Connecticut. So you have all these, my point is it's almost like a no man's land or is a no man's land with all these different crime families operating in a state that's, you know, you can get from one half or from one part to the other, you know, from top to bottom, you can go through the state in an hour. Yes. And you have all these different groups. And then within those groups, these OC figures who all, I'm sure, know each other because it's a small state, but they all represent different groups. So it makes it, I guess, a little bit stickier than maybe.
The way it's been set up since I was assigned to the New Haven office was this way. The New Haven County and some of the counties around New Haven County were traditionally New England crime family. That was run out of Providence. It was run out of Boston, when Frank Salemi was the boss. And then when Louis Minacchio took over, when Frank got locked up and went into WITSEC and everything, when Louis took over, it was run out of Providence. So Providence sold.
And now it's back. Now it's back to Boston. But now Providence it's back still, to
Boston.
But now Providence it's still bounced, has a right. Has still has a.
It's
a
bounced strong. Back and forth a bunch of times. I interviewed Frank Salemi one time. I asked him why he picked Louis Minacchio. He kind of rolled his eyes and he said it was a big mistake. But one of the reasons he said he picked Louis was he wanted to keep Providence happy.
That's rich. You know, so, just to digress for 1 second, that's a rich statement coming from Cadillac Frank, because all due respect to Cadillac Frank, and I met him a couple times and we were actually working on a book proposal together. I've told the story before that never went anywhere, but that was he rolled his eyes at it. That was a good choice. Minacchio put that family back together after Salemi had torn it apart with his, ego and rampage of vengeance on people that had tried to kill him back in the 80s. So it's just is Minacchio. I know that Minacchio is somebody. I know that Louis is somebody that elicits strong opinions on both sides. People either love him or have a dislike for him. But he had a good 15-year run where that family got stability back and respect back after a lot of problems in the late 80s, early to mid 90s.
Toward the back end of the time that Minacchio was running things, he was driving everybody in his family nuts because right. He wouldn't rule on anything. He wouldn't get near anything. He wouldn't really get involved in anything that involved another family, which a lot of times, as New England got weaker, more and more, there was more and more encroachment from other families up into Massachusetts. Right. And he would never get involved in that type of thing because he was always afraid the conversations were recorded or he was going to get in more trouble than he was already in.
Well, listen, this is really in some ways 35 years in the making. You can trace it all the way back to when Billy Grasso gets killed in the summer of 89. People know it, bringing Frank Salemi back into the story, the double hit on a hot summer day in June of 89. The Boston guys try to take out Salemi and Grasso on the same day. They kill Grasso. They're unsuccessful in killing Salemi. He survives six shots or whatever, seven shots. But ever since then, I mean, there's blood in the water. I mean, there's never been a force of nature like Billy Grasso where people knew that they couldn't encroach without him killing them on the spot. But it's been kind of a musical chairs of people trying to get that standing back for Connecticut in the New England mob orbit.
I mean, when Billy basically took over the state and became a capo, he drove up 91 and he threw Tony Volpe out of the city of Hartford. Tony had been sitting up there as an associate. He never got made. He'd been sitting up there as an associate forever. And everybody knew exactly where to find him.
He eventually got made, but it took him a while to get made.
Yeah, I mean, most of the time he got made apparently not too long before he died.
Yeah, I know they made him late. They made him late.
Most of the time he was active in LCN activities.
Right,
he was an associate.
Yeah,
and he was a Genovese associate. So as you were saying about the state, it's odd because you had two during the time that I was investigating LCN, you had two soldiers sitting in New Haven that weren't all that active. That was Mario Grasso, that's Billy's son, and Anthony Asensio. And then down in Stamford, the Gambinos had moved after Frank Piccolo got whacked. The Gambinos had kind of moved, drifted, and Tommy DeBrisi got whacked. The Gambinos had drifted down into Stamford, and that was kind of their seat of power. It was closer to New York, and they were down there. And then up in Hartford, and into Springfield, that was all Genovese.
Right.
So you had three families kind of peacefully coexisting in different parts of the state doing different types of things.
So,
and then we had a you know, we did a, on my squad, a couple of agents, we did a massive carding case. And
that well, that's a whole episode. So I'm going to try. Jamie has just a wealth of information. I'm going to try to do a series with Jamie. So he, if people remember or remember, I shouldn't say remember, it's pretty recent. In the last year or two or 2 or 3 years, there was a, there's been a Netflix, Untold on the story of the Danbury Trashers hockey team, which was a present from a mob figure, to his son, in the late 90s, early 2000s. This guy was a right underneath Maddie the Horse. It's a fascinating case that I want to do a whole episode on with you.
You have the wrong guy. I was the,
I'm sorry, the case, I
worked on the case. I had a role in the case. The case agent on that case is one of the best FBI agents I ever worked with, named Jeff Waterman.
So you're talking about someone that, when you just referenced, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to jump in and hijack me. I thought you were talking about the Danbury case, the Danbury Trashers. And
I was.
Oh, you were. Okay. You're just saying that case, you weren't.
I wasn't the main guy.
The agent. But I would love to have both you guys on to talk about it.
You're better off with just Jeff. He knows that case backwards and forwards. We had an undercover in there who was incredible. It was an enormous case. I think it was 30 or 40 arrests. And it took us 3 days to do all the searches that we did. And what ended up happening as a result of that case was most of the LCN activity, the actual LCN figures that were involved, were down in New York. And my supervisor at the time, named Bill Reiner, who was just an incredible leader, he was really good at picking out which agent would be good for this job, which agent would be good for that job. After we had done the Wise Kings wire, he decided to move me completely off of Safe Streets and move me into doing nothing but LCN and organized crime. And one of the things he asked me to target is all the New York soldiers. Nobody had really paid a lot of attention to him, particularly when we were doing the case with the Trashers and the Pale Rider case. So those guys were just, nobody had really been doing any surveillance on them or had any intelligence about them. And my supervisor asked me to start looking at that. And that's when I started focusing on Anthony Asenzia and finding an informant to get information about what he was doing.
So
Asenzia had already done about maybe 3 years in jail on a bookmaking case that predecessors on my squad had done. And when he got out of the case, he just really hated jail more than the average mope. He just hated it. And he really didn't want to go back. So when he got out, he was extremely cautious about what he was doing. He was never as active as he was when he went in.
We're talking about Beaver.
And
Beaver said
he was tough getting intelligence about him. He was very low level activity from him. And Mario Grasso was never really an active soldier either. So we ended up kind of fishing around a little bit and getting bits and pieces and putting a lot of different types of things together.
Yeah. So let me set this
and
up.
During that time, there was an associate of Asenzia's who was very disgruntled because he got the most jail time out of anybody that went away. And nobody took care of his family. He had a mom that was sick and other family members. He was angry about that. And I had heard a lot of information about him, and I thought he was a guy to cold flip. In other words, you just approach him and you try and flip him. He's not jammed up to see if he'll cooperate. And took a lot of time, and we did. We got him to cooperate, and he started acting as a source for us on our squad. And he got involved in a bunch of different cases. But one of the things that he was telling us about was that there was a renegade member of the Gambino crime family out of Bridgeport and Stamford that was shaking down and threatening all the New England crime family bookmakers. And he basically decided that he wanted to take over all the bookmaking activities and some of the narcotics activities up in New Haven County, up in the area. And he was going from bookmaker to bookmaker, who are all kicking up to Eddie Perret.
You're talking about Sonny Sooner.
Yes.
Okay. Raul Sooner, Sonny Sooner, was a teenage errand boy for Frankie Piccolo.
Yes.
And then came, I don't think he's another guy that I don't think he'll ever get a button because he's not full-breded Italian. I think he's half Spanish, half Italian, but was exactly. very, very liked, very trusted by a lot of yes. powerful Gambinos, I think even to today. But we're talking about a kind of a takeover attempt that Sonny Sooner yeah. launched in around 2006 yes. and targeted Beaver Asenza's crew and all the patriarchal rackets in the area. I'm gonna throw it back to you, but it's interesting that this thing resulted in a couple of sit downs, yes. and then a bunch of people went to prison. But in the sit downs, you had the patriarchal guys from Providence coming in or being brought in to sit down with the Gambinos over this. And after the sit down, the Bobby DeLucas and the good looking Maddies, well, Maddie wasn't involved because Maddie was in prison at that point, but the Bobby DeLuca is mad at his own guys, basically saying, like, you brought this upon us. By you guys not being on your right. P's and Q's, you let these guys in a matter of a couple of years come in and gouge us. So, like, he was yes. it's just interesting that the opinion from the patriarchas, even though they had to stand up for themselves in those sit-downs, they almost were like, they blamed their own guys for allowing it to happen.
They should have, yeah. because they did. I mean, Sonny, that's Raul Sooner's nickname. Sonny came up and muscled. We interviewed probably 20 bookmakers. He threatened to kill people
it's real
if they
brutal.
Didn't start kicking up directly to him.
It's real brutal. I wrote a story recently on my Gangster Report website, and I break down some of the instances that Sonny Sooner attack people. In one case, he baseball batted a guy's knees. Yep. Another case, yep. I think it's actually the same guy owed him $13,000. He baseball bats him when the mm-hmm. guy refuses to turn over his Corvette. He says to Sooner, I'm not going to give you my Corvette, and if you take it, I'm going to call the police and report it stolen. From that, he gets his Sooner baseball bats his knees. A yep. month later, he calls him to a meeting in Milford, puts a knife to his throat.
Yes.
And then you guys were able to tie him to the attack because he cuts himself when he's putting yes. the knife to the guy's throat, bleeds on the guy's clothes, and you're able to DNA match him to the.
Yeah. The toughest part about that whole case is, ironically, is the victim had brought his jacket to the cleaners and left it there. Never picked it up. And we couldn't find the jacket. So this cleaners was getting ready to go out of business. Myself and another couple of agents spent about 4 hours searching that in every piece of clothing in that cleaners. Until we found that jacket, we ended up finding it. And then we sent it to the lab and tested it for DNA. And it came back with the victim's DNA on it. So that's part of the way we made him. The other thing that occurred was part of Sonny's crew was this guy who was an extremely active burglar, residential and commercial burglar.
Bobby the Cat, Tagliaferri?
Yes.
Yeah.
And Tagliaferri screwed up because he burglarized a Connecticut state senator's house in the middle of the day over in Hamden. And in the middle of the burglary, or toward the end of the burglary, he hears the front door open up. He always went in through the second story. He used to use these climbing spikes and he'd nail them into the side of the house and hit chinny up, go into the bedroom window. he was only going after cash and jewelry. He didn't get electronics or anything like that. He had the same routine he used. He had a running suit on. He had a pouch. He'd put all the swag in there. And then he'd shinny back down the side of the house and go to his car. So in the middle of this burglary, the state senator's wife came home because she had forgotten something on her way to a meeting. And Tagliaferri saw her come through the front. He ran down the stairs and hit her by mistake and knocked her down. So now it becomes a robbery. But what was more important than that was this is not long after the horrible crime that had been committed over in Cheshire with that home invasion that it turned into.
Oh, my God. Makes your stomach turn. For people that don't know, the Cheshire murders, there was an HBO documentary on it. One of the most depraved crimes, and forget about Connecticut. I mean, these two guys bust into this house, rape the women, set it on fire. Everybody dies except the husband. Oh, God, brutal.
And what happened was the state senator of Connecticut rightfully had really jacked up home invasion guidelines, sentencing guidelines. So Tagliaferri knocks down the state senator's wife. She gets a slight injury, but she gets injured. He jumps into his car, takes off. Hamden PD arrests him. I get contacted because they knew we were working the case because a Hamden police officer was on our task force. And we ended up interviewing him. And I told him that he was looking at doing probably about 20 years because he had a bad sheet. So he flicked. So we started working Tagliaferri into Sonny, who was Raul Sooner. And one of the things that Sonny wanted to do was he wanted to get a gun because he wanted to start murdering these bookmakers that weren't cooperating with him. So we used an inert silenced gun with an obliterated serial number that we got from FBI headquarters. And we had Tagliaferri sell Sonny that gun. And when he bought it, he bought himself a 10-year sentence.
Yep.
With his criminal history, plus it was a silenced gun, plus it had an obliterated serial number, he was looking at a lot of jail.
That was March of 08. That was March of 08 when you guys busted him on the silencer case, and then he got hit with the racketeering case the year after that. I know we're all over the place here, but I think there's some rhyme to the some rhyme to our reason or reason to our rhyme or whatever the terminology is. You were mentioning the home invasions, and I just want to get your take on this. So there was a pretty powerful, respected Gambino that lived in Connecticut named Nick the Greaser, Nick the Greaseball, Malia.
Nick Malia.
Yeah. And his house, there was a home invasion, a burglary stick up at his residence over a decade ago. And one of the people that was suspected of playing a role was a Patriarca crime family associate, a black guy named Napoleon Andrades, or Nappy, who was a bodyguard, messenger, driver at some points for Louis Minocchio. I know that might sound strange, but and he had to do a prison sentence for something not related to the home invasion. And he got out a couple years ago. And within a week, he was killed in the parking lot of his halfway house in Pawtucket. A lot of people believe that that was ordered and carried out in response to the home invasion of Nick the Greaseball's house. Does that kind of fit with what we were talking about before, and just the way that these guys operate, and how you have the cross pollination of these groups, and how sometimes it gets messy?
I don't have any personal knowledge of that. When that whole thing happened,
but you do know Nick, though. You can talk a little bit about
Nick. Oh yeah, I mean, Nick Malia was in Stanford as part of the Gambino crime family forever. I mean, he was down there with Tony McGailey and all the this the like I said, after Tommy DeBrisi got murdered in Bridgeport, who took over for Frank Piccolo when Frank Piccolo got murdered, the seat of power for the Gambinos kind of permanently moved to Stanford.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy who's kind of running things down there now is a guy named Dean DePretta, who's been active with that family for a long, long time.
Yep. He was a guy that went to prison, came out about 5 years ago. And I've reported in the last month or so that they call him Baldino. That Mr. DePretta is now the guy that's running Gambino Affairs in Connecticut. I don't know if that means that he's a skipper. I know that he has, I shouldn't say I know, I'm well sourced that he has been made since he came out of prison. He hadn't been made when he went away, but he was, again, kind of like Sonny Sooner, kind of like Eddie Perrette, not made, but has the status of a made guy, and not just a made guy, but like a quasi skipper. So let's talk about Dino.
Most of the time I was working organized crime, DePretta hadn't become a soldier. He was always associate.
No, just recently, since he got out of prison in the last 5 years, I'm told he got a butt.
Yeah. The Gambino thread that was ironic back then, and a lot of your listeners might not know about this. I don't know how much you've talked about it, is that the guy who was very active coming up to Connecticut at that time was Nicky Skin Stefanelli.
Yeah, who the Gambino, who was wired up, got a ton of incriminating conversations from multiple families, and then ended up killing himself. And the guy that he blamed for having to flip, a guy that they called him Joe Phoenix. I think his last name was Joe Rossi. I think his real name is Joe Rossi. But So
Nicky Skins wired up against a guy for me. He was working targets up in Boston. He did some targets in New Haven. He did a ton of stuff in New York and Jersey and Philadelphia. And we all kind of debriefed him. He had a steel trap memory. He'd been in and out of the can so much that he knew everybody. I mean, that's the funny thing about sources, is that, you know, that they call prison the College of Evil. I mean, you're learning so much about different people and making relationships. You get into these things, they call them a car, which is like a group of people that you hang around with when you're in jail. And some of the best sources that I've ever worked with were guys that got into these cars, whether they're in Lewisburg or Allenwood or Otisville, wherever they go, with other LCN guys. And that's what Nicky Skins did. He could talk to, he knew everybody. He knew people from a lot of other families, and a lot of FBI cases were based on his testimony. And when he killed himself, it tanked dozens of cases and probable cause for a lot of different Title III wiretaps.
Yeah. And let's just real quickly draw the line between Dino DePretta and Eddie Perrette in modern times, and then we can go back again. So Eddie hangs out at Doma, which is his restaurant. He co-owns Doma with Johnny Mops, Johnny LaCourie, who is a Gambino guy under DePretta. What do you know about Johnny Mops, Johnny the Mop?
Not a whole lot. He popped up in a case that we had. There was a Gambino, kind of a rebel, who sat up in New Haven for years. And New England never did anything about him because he was one of these OG guys. But he was a tough dude, but he was a made guy. And nobody bothered him. So there was always a little bit of Gambino back and forth between Stanford, Bridgeport, and New Haven. He's since passed away. His name was Eddie Raiolino. And Raul Sooner, who we've been talking about, tried to shake Eddie Raiolino down, and Eddie Raiolino took his car keys, put all the keys between his knuckles, and punched Sonny in the face. And Sonny wanted to kill him, and the Gambinos ended up interceding and then stopped it from happening. So there's always been a little bit of Gambino influence up in New Haven, and a little bit of tension between New England and Gambino.
I'm pretty sure you told me that you were up on a wire where LaCorey popped up.
We were. He popped up on the phone. It was a bunch of calls, bookmaking type of calls. Nothing that we could indict him on, but he was certainly associating with those guys when we were doing the Wise Kings wire. And he was in the middle of a lot of the stuff that they were doing. It was a very active bookmaking operation. And as I said, it was when they first started moving. It was the advent of the internet. And it was the beginning of the internet. So you could run operations like that offshore and away from the FBI and away from the United States. And people could keep track of their bets, and everything was being done online. The role that the LCN guys really played in it was lending the players money. That's where the crime came in. Because that's how, if somebody is a degenerate gambler, they have to have money to spend on betting. So they'd look at their accounts, and this guy's out of money, and the player would come back and say, I need $10,000. There's a lot of football games I want to bet on this weekend. And they would extend credit, you know, with extortionate rates, and they were making a lot of money doing that.
So Eddie Perrette initially starts, again, I know this is, we're all over the place, but Eddie Perrette initially starts kind of with the Gambinos as a younger guy. He goes to prison, and between going to prison and leaving prison, or in the preceding months after prison, he's kind of switched over to the Patriarchas and gets close with Beaver Asenzia and starts making a reputation for himself, at least in the Patriarchas orbit. I know that Providence took notice pretty quickly that he's a guy that knew how to make money, keep his head down. I mean, yeah, he's taken pinches before, but he's a real stealthy guy in terms of how he conducts himself, and added to that, fat envelopes that he can provide allegedly has really endeared himself, I'm told, to Eddie Lato and Matty Guglielmetti in Providence, and that they have a lot of love and trust for him, and that they meet with him. You know, there's no liaisoning because he's not a full made guy. Like, they sit with him, and sometimes they come see him. He doesn't necessarily always go see them. Most of the time he goes sees them, but the fact that they would even go to Connecticut says something.
End of that case where Perrette was targeted, and we went into and we did the case against Raul Sooner, and then that came down. That drove Anthony Asenzia and Mario Grasso further underground. There was very little activity coming from the two of them. So my source contacted me and said, I just heard that Bobby DeLuca came down last week. And, you know, Bobby DeLuca is obviously a
Bobby LCN the Cigar, soldier. Yeah, Providence capo, eventually a cooperator. Hated Louie.
Right. What happened was Bobby DeLuca came down and he met with Asenzia and Grasso and said, you know, where's your booster? Where's the money? Where are the envelopes? You guys aren't doing anything down here. If you need muscle, give me a call. I'll send muscle down here. But you're not running a shy. You're not doing anything. It's an embarrassment.
The money had gone from a steady flow to a drip Woodruff over the 10 years.
And every time there was an increased law enforcement activity, the further and further Asensia and Grasso would kind of go underground and stay away from anything that could cause them to get in trouble with law enforcement. But the irony of the entire thing is DeLuca has this meeting, threatens them, all this type of stuff. And then 2 weeks later, he flips.
Right.
And he ends up flipping on the case with Frank Salemi's son. So after that happened, the activity in New Haven dropped off to nothing. It was very little going on LCN-wise when that happened, because DeLuca had been the kind of liaison between Louis and Eddie Lado and Googly Medi and all those guys to New Haven. He was the guy who took care of everything down here.
So Bieber might have had the button, but it seems like Eddie was the one that was getting everything back together. And then when Bieber died, it from what I'm told, it's allowed Eddie to kind of take control of that group. But the Maddies and the little Eddies of the world, and I'm sure the Denunzios are well aware of all this too, they were crediting Eddie for putting it, for getting the spigot back on full flow.
Right. I mean, you know, Eddie Perrette was a really smart, active kind of man about town type of bookmaker. He knew a lot of people. And as I said, when he lost the bet, he paid. So he had a lot of customers. And everybody knew he wasn't going to cooperate with law enforcement. A really active guy around the New Haven area. And he knew people from other families. He didn't cause any trouble, and he kicked up. So those type of associates, I don't know if he's a soldier now or not. I'm out of the game, but
I don't. We're talking about Eddie. I don't think he can be made. I don't know.
They make exceptions.
Yeah, they make exceptions.
It's not the way it used to be.
He's half French.
I mean, Frank Salemi was half Irish.
Right. Salemi was half Irish. Jimmy Marcello, who became a boss of Chicago, was half Irish. There are rumors about Andy Campos, who's a big, big time Gambino. People, claim that he might be partially Puerto Rican but nonetheless, Andy Campos could become boss one day. It's all about green, man. It's not so much about what color your blood is. It's about how much green you're kicking up.
That's really what's, you have a bunch of guys in LCN. They get up every day saying to themselves, how am I going to make some money today? What am I going to do?
Right.
And they have a specialty, whether they're a bookmaker or, there's obviously been LCN activity in the stock market. You have other ones that own businesses, but you'll have these guys that are kind of, they can do a lot of different stuff to make money. You talk quite a bit about Joey Merlino. Don't forget, I mean, one of the things that Joey Merlino did was he needed money and he robbed a bank.
Right.
I mean, you got to do what you got to do.
Armored car. Yeah, that was his armored car. That's how he first kind of blasted onto the, I mean, not really. He'd been on the scene before as a gopher and errand boy for all those Scarfo soldiers. But that was his first kind of debut as a primetime player in the Philadelphia underworld. He got some headlines, and then we were just talking about it. He went away to prison and made some connections. And those connections were able to, he was able to parlay into backing for a war against Stanfa that he won when he was 30 some years old, and he's been boss ever since. So the prison sentence helped Joey.
Oh yeah. I mean, I don't know how many, you probably have a lot of Eagles fans listening to you, but I interviewed Joey Merlino maybe about 10 years ago. And one of the things that I remember most about the interview is he's a huge Patriots fan.
Oh, no, he loves Brady. He's no. Let's get it clear. He's a huge Tom Brady fan.
Okay.
He's.
Well, he told me he was a Patriots fan.
Well, that's because Tom Brady was on the team. Now, when Brady moved
to the Boston, Sixers, the Phillies.
Yeah.
The Flyers and the Patriots. He doesn't like the Eagles.
No, and he's a unabashed Tom Brady lover, and he loves himself some Barstool and Dave Portnoy. Those are like his two. those are his like. If he had to put together a dream dinner, I think he would want a Portnoy, maybe Joe Rogan, and Tom Brady.
You know, Jeff. I mean, obviously, it's pre-internet, but talking about Philadelphia organized crime, the guy in the New England crime family who would fit like a glove into Philadelphia organized crime was Billy Grasso.
Yeah.
He was that type of, like a John Vesey type of absolutely incredibly tough, scary guy.
Yeah.
That everybody was afraid of.
Terrified. And that's why he was terrified of him.
He ruled with an iron fist here, and when he died, it created this void that kind of sort of exists to this day, where you have, you know, families that are elbowing each other a little bit, but nothing really heavy happened after the 89 murder of
based on court files and some FBI 302s and just my own sourcing. Right after Grasso died, it made it so the Providence Patriarchs felt like they had to come in and immediately take oversight. They obviously didn't really trust anybody boots on the ground at that point, 89, 90, to take over for Billy. So Matty Guglielmetti essentially took over as... I mean, he wasn't the skipper of Connecticut. He was his own skipper in Providence, but he got the responsibility of the Connecticut guys. And there was a series of meetings where Maddie came to Connecticut, or they might have gone to Providence. I'm mixing it up. But within a couple days or a week of Grasso being killed, Google and Maddie came and got the whole Connecticut crew together and said, now you guys report to me now.
I've heard stories from older agents and police officers. Billy's the kind of guy that would get out of his car and just walk up to somebody who owed him money and hadn't paid it and crack him right across the face himself.
Yeah.
He didn't grab a soldier or an associate and say, well, he'd do it himself. He had no compunction about doing that type of thing. And when you saw him coming, the street just cleared away. That's the type of gangster he was. He was an all-time type of guy who ruled with an iron fist.
Yeah.
And he wasn't flashy. He was
a bull in a China shop.
The bull in a China shop and a formidable opponent for the other families. And I, you know, obviously Raymond Patriarca saw something that he liked when he met him when they were again in prison. And that's why he put him in charge down there.
Yeah, they were cellmates. Do you remember hearing anything? This was before your time, the last year or so of Billy Grasso. Do you remember hearing about the Billy Miller situation?
Yes.
So yes. For people that might not know, and then I'll just get Jamie's whatever knowledge or anecdotes he has. But Billy Miller was a local mob collector, but he was also like a professional or semi-professional boxer. He worked with Sonny Castagna and Jackie Johns. And I think it was summer of 88 or fall of 88. Grasso gets killed in summer of 89. Billy Miller goes to Franco's, which was Billy Grasso's restaurant. He's like joking with a friend of his on the sidewalk, and they're kind of like calling each other racial slurs, but not with any like malice behind it. Because he was Irish and he was talking to an Italian guy. And when you start throwing around Italian racial slurs around a guy like Billy Grasso, that's not going to fly. Grasso went in and told Billy Miller basically to shut his mouth, and Billy Miller clocked him, like laid him out. A month later, Billy Miller is dead behind the wheel of his SUV. Not shocking.
What I know about that case is Hartford Police Department beat their brains out trying to solve that case. And it all came down to the people that were in the car when he was murdered. And it was conflicting stories and finger pointing. And it ended up being one cooperator's word against another. And it just wasn't good enough to make an arrest. But Hartford PD really, really worked that thing real hard. And it just, unfortunately, some cold cases get, they get better with age and some don't. Because people get older and their memories fail and they don't want anything to do with cooperating and they just couldn't make the case. I met with a couple of the detectives a couple of times and told them the vague information that I had about it, that I had passed it on to them. I had gotten from a couple of sources, but they just never had enough to make an arrest on that case. And
what do you think of Billy Miller? I mean, like, I understand some people have tempers and they're not thinking, but this guy knew the ice that he was treading on. And to think that you could, I mean, even put your head, forget about knocking out, just putting your hands on someone like Billy Grasso or saying, saying a word that Grasso could be offended by could get you killed. And a professional fighter, your hands are basically lethal weapons. And you take a swing at this guy, you're just like, you might as well have just shot yourself right there.
Yeah. And like I said, I mean, Billy had a reputation that was, there's never been a gangster here in Connecticut that even touched him for how much fear he brought to opponents, civilians. Never. I mean, the only figure that I can think of that had a similar reputation. He wasn't a soldier. He was an enforcer for Franny Curcio, who was a made guy. Was a Genovese
Fat
soldier.
Fat Franny.
Was there's a Hell's Angel.
Yeah. Diamond Dave.
Diamond Danny Byfield.
I didn't say Diamond Dan. I don't know why I said Diamond Dave. I was thinking of David Lee Roth. Diamond Danny Byfield.
He was described to me by a cooperator once as a sack of cement with a leather jacket over it. And that's what he looked like. He was a jacked up, really scary enforcer for the Curcio brothers. And
he's Hell's Angels boss of Bridgeport. And then he went down in the 2000s and opened up Hell's Angels chapter in South Carolina. And he's a kind of a legend in Hell's Angels circles, someone whose reputation precedes him wherever he goes. Just got out of prison.
He was chapter president when the Hell's Angels chapter was one of the most feared and violent on the East Coast way back when. And Danny worked for, I know he worked a lot with the Curcios. He might have even worked a little bit with the Gambinos, I'm not sure. But they operated, the Curcios operated strip joints down in, they still do, down in Bridgeport. And Byfield was doing a lot of different stuff with them.
Billy, I should say for Billy Miller, though, as I'm thinking about that case, I'm not defending him, but I am saying that I believe that he punched Grasso out as Grasso was, I think Grasso was like charging at him. So I think maybe he was going to argue self-defense.
The vague recollection I have about the facts is I think, was Grasso doing some gardening or something?
Yeah, Grasso had gardening clippers in his hand or something.
Yeah, in front of the restaurant
right
when the incident occurred. So his days were kind of numbered once that happened.
And then you had around the same time, you had a popular restaurateur who was also a big time bookie, Billy Hot Dog Grant, was killed in the same couple months that Billy Miller was killed. And this was all in the months preceding Billy Grasso being assassinated.
Right. That's right.
Did they find Hot Dog Grant's body underneath that house?
Yes.
Yeah.
They found the body.
I think they believe he was killed in a parking lot.
All that stuff occurred probably within 6 or 7 years of me getting to the office.
No, I know.
And they were just getting done with that part of the case.
Augie and Ray's was the name of the place that Hot Dog Grant owned. Disappeared on his way to his kid's high school graduation, I think.
Yes.
So this was great. I'm definitely going to get Jamie back soon to talk about the role that he played in the Gardner Museum investigation. And we're going to do a whole episode on that, because for people that have followed the Gardner Museum case, you know, most infamous art heist in world history, $500 million of art taken from a museum in Boston, St. Patrick's Day 90 or 91. Still haven't found the paintings, but for people that have followed the investigation led right into Connecticut, and some pretty big pieces of information in the investigation came out of Connecticut Wise Guys. Just to tease it a little more, I'm sure a lot of people already know this, but these Connecticut Wise Guys weren't really, well, some of them were tied into the Patriarchas, but some of them were made guys in Joey Merlino's crew from Philadelphia. And the Philly guys in the 90s went up to New England and made a bunch of guys. And then some of those paintings allegedly made their way to Philly in the 2000s. It's unbelievably compelling. We're going to have you back on to talk about it. But thank you so much for sharing your knowledge on Connecticut LCN. This was definitely one of my favorite episodes of it.
Thank you very much. Anytime.
Jamie, thank you so much. I'm sure the audience is going to love this. And we're going to bring you a straight from the horse's mouth Gardner Museum heist episode soon. We'll have Jamie back. And then maybe we'll have Jamie back on with Jeff, the FBI agent that was
Jeff was the lead
with
guy.
The Danbury Trashers case.
Right. Oh, with Jeff Waterman. Oh, yeah. They incredible. There was a whole team of guys that did that case. And they did I played a low level in it. And everybody not only on our squad was involved in that case, the entire division. And one of the things I remember when they did the takedown, every heavy hitter, expensive attorney in the state of Connecticut was in Judge Burns' courtroom that day. Because everybody lawyered right up, and we had arrested maybe 30 people. And Jimmy Galante was the guy who ran the...
That was the main guy, and the trash company guy that was at that time an associate, was right underneath Maddie the horse. Very well could be made at this point, but it was his son that he gave the trashers to.
That's right.
Quay, go check it out on Netflix. It's a great, it's a crazy story. Jamie, thank you so much. We're teasing out what we're going to be having coming down the pike from Connecticut OC through the spring and summer of 24 for Jeff in the future. Jeff Waterman, we're looking forward to having you on. But for Jamie, for Benny, and everybody else, OG Pod, Scott Bernstein, we're out.